Hello and welcome to the programme. The call of the Buick Swan, once a familiar sound across our countryside, may be in danger of falling silent. Beavers are making a comeback in England and Scotland. We ask if you might see them in a river near you anytime soon. And Terry Flanagan talks to primary school children in Tyrrellstown who are preparing to welcome spring.
We make bird feeders. We put them on the trees and the birds come eat them.
You can't feed them everything because some could be allergic and maybe could die. Like, for small birds, you won't put, like, everything, like, big stuff they can't swallow down their throats because they could choke. We will put little seeds that they could actually swallow.
Right.
And, like, small stuff.
So a very busy programme ahead of us today. In studio we've got Aina Nilana, Richard Collins and Ferdy Marnell, Head of Animal Ecology at the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Guys, I'm glad you're here. I want you to have a listen to something I recorded, not today or yesterday, last week. I was out on the grounds of Orty and I recorded this bird singing. Have a listen now. Push it up all the way there, Sheila, if you would. Now, I recorded this on my mobile phone, so excuse the quality.
Better tomorrow.
Some big discussion. One of the managers walking by in the background, having a big discussion about whether I'm going to be sacked or not, probably.
No, they're probably saying, isn't it amazing to hear a blackbird singing in January?
Yes.
Because it's January
it's
when
January.
You recorded that.
Yes.
I know it's February now when this programme is being broadcast, but January was really mild towards the end of the month. Lots of birds singing. I've been hearing great tits, we've been hearing robins, we've been hearing blackbirds, and I'm sure there have been thrushes too, have there not, Richard?
Yes, usually you hear the mistle thrush first. I've heard song thrushes often in the last month, which is very interesting. It's the birds that nest successively two, maybe even three times that do this kind of thing, because the first nest is a high-risk one, you know. If you nest now, well, you might pull it off, but the chances are you won't, because a terrible cold spell will come in, or the worms will stay deep down and you can't feed. You'll pick up on the second.
Well, you're in Malahide. Are they singing in Malahide?
There's a song thrush singing near my house. Lovely, beautiful song thrush. Gorgeous.
Aina, you're in Terranure?
And we have robins. We haven't, and blackbirds in the evening time, but not in the morning.
And Ferdy Marnell, where are you based, Ferdy?
I'm in Shankill, and we have robins and blackbirds.
No, so the robin should be singing because that's the bird that sings all year round. But you have the blackbird singing as well. This has been happening for years and years. The birds are singing early, and we mention it when we hear them singing early. And people have been saying to me, oh, they're only rehearsing their song. That sounds like the full song of a blackbird to me, Richard.
It is what you heard there. There is a thing called the sub song or plastic song, which is birds in the autumn, young birds, develop a kind of weak version of this. They're trying to imitate their father. They're practicing. But that becomes full song. The plastic song merges into full song in spring. And what I've heard, I heard a great tit pumping away, bicycle pumping.
Teacher.
Yeah, during the week. A great tit. Well, now, that is very odd, because the great tit is going to wait until May or something before he's going to be feeding young. It's a bit early to be worrying about it. And he picks his wife out in the flocks. He's not looking for a wife, you know. Whereas the others might be looking for a wife, advertising themselves.
But I heard a great tit too.
So what the hell is he at this early? Wouldn't he be better off fattening up and not wasting his time? The song is terribly demanding.
I know. I mean, are they not wasting their energy now doing it?
Men like to show off, don't they?
Well, it's a tricky one, because the triggering factor seems to be daylight length. The birds have clocks and their gonads are shrunk
rhythms
to nothing at this time of year. They're almost almost asexual coming into spring. But then the daylight length triggers the release of hormones which bring the gonads up, and they become male and female. That's the way they work.
What do you mean they become male and female?
Well,
I mean, are you telling me when a bird is born that it's not male or female at that point?
Technically, yes, but its gonads are shrunk to nothing. It's a non-sexual animal, you know. It's neutral, you know. The robin singing in winter is not sexual in any sense, do you say?
But none of us are. But we can determine whether we're male or female at birth.
Well,
in most cases.
Well, we can't. You and I have an advantage because we have the information to create females within us, whereas poor Olena here has only the information in her genes to create. You haven't. You can't. You can only be a female.
I can always give an X chromosome. You lot can either give an X or a Y. I presume that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, we have Adam's rib. Adam's rib confers, but the birds are the opposite. It is the females that have Adam's rib. Remember the famous case a few years ago that we went to investigate in West Dublin of the duck which changed sex, Derek? Do you remember that?
You know, I believe you if you tell me. I don't remember yesterday, bizarrely, but go on.
And this duck did change sex because it had, the drake died in these domestic ducks, and one of the females decided it would become a male. So it had the instructions on board to do so, and the people who had these ducks said, what in the name of God, the duck is after producing eggs, they must be infertile. And then goslings hatched, you know. So
Hang on a minute now. You said the drake died, the duck became a man, and then how did it lay eggs and why did it turn into goslings?
Well, it didn't lay the eggs. It mated with the other three females and they produced an egg on the basis of this, do you see? So here you had a case of sex change. But remember, the female has all the instructions on board. You take the crocodiles, Derek. Look at the crocodile. You're familiar with crocodiles. When it's below 30 degrees, they are
females. Below 32 degrees Celsius in the nest, you get females. Above 32 degrees Celsius, you get males. Not all the time, but in most cases. And it's determined by the mother. And I learned this in a place called Gainesville in Florida. I was out with Professor Louis Gillette and his students, and they were studying reproduction in alligators. And he told me that they found, not 100% of the time, but I think it was 90%, give or take, of the time, that if the females, at a critical point during incubation, see, they could lay anything up to 60 eggs in a nest, and at a critical point in the incubation, they would lie in the nest and increase the temperature, or get off the nest and let the temperature cool down. And by increasing the temperature to over 32 degrees, they'd get male alligators. And by decreasing it, by getting off and letting it cool down, they'd get female alligators. Hard to believe, I know, but Gainesville is an extraordinary place. If you ever get the chance to go to Florida, go to Gainesville. Because anybody listening to this who's from America will tell you, it is the home of one of the most famous American college football teams, the Gators. And they play at a stadium called The Swamp. And if you walk around the town, on the bush shelters, you see icons of alligators. On car registration plates, you see icons of alligators. And over some shop fronts, you see icons of alligators. And then, if you go for a walk down near the watercourses, you just see alligators lying on the side of the canal banks. It's extraordinary. Somebody told me, actually, when I was there are more alligators in Florida than there are people. I don't believe that, but there are certainly a lot of alligators. And there's a name for this sex determination, and it's called temperature dependent sex determination, TSD, temperature dependent sex determination. You'll never forget that. You'll be talking about it tomorrow in work at the water cooler. TSD, temperature dependent sex determination. Below 32 degrees, they're female.
They're female. And why? Because the females have both sets of instructions, like you and I have in our Adam's rib.
Do you understand all this, Ferdy? You should. Well, you're a zoologist.
Yeah, the Wilsons have done that sort of zoology, transsexual 101. But I know fish do it as well. A lot of rats, for example, will change. And they're very plastic and they can respond to the environment. So, for example, if there's a lot of males, then they can, individuals can turn to females and vice versa. So, I mean, a lot of species do show some plasticity in their gender, all right?
The great beneficiary is the biggest reptile of all, the Komodo dragon. If a Komodo decides this is getting a bit crowded, a female heads off to another island. Do you see? Well, now she's on the other island, but she has no mate. So what does she do? She breeds young nonetheless because she has the instructions on board for both males and females, and some of the babies will be male. And then she starts to breed with her sons and start a new colony of Komodo dragons. About 52 species of reptile and some snakes don't bother with males at all. What's the phrase, the virgin birth?
Parthenogenesis.
Parthenogenesis. They're parthenogenic, yeah.
That's what it is. Never a dull moment on this programme. From early singing birds and, as I mentioned, TSD, we turn our attention to nature's engineer, the beaver.
A beaver, one of the family that lives here in this lake at the foot of the Teton Mountains in Wyoming. They're accomplished engineers. This great pond is entirely their own creation. Only a few years ago, this shallow, pebbly stream flowed straight down the valley. Then a family of beavers moved in and built a dam. The main body of it is built of boulders. On the downstream side, it's been lined with logs, some of them big and quite heavy, and on this side, it's been packed with mud and vegetation. It's been built so accurately that it is to within a few inches horizontal across its entire length of about 150 yards from one side to the other. And the lake it's created stretches upstream for almost a mile.
David Attenborough reminding us from his BBC series Life of Mammals what an industrious lot beavers are. And it's because of their extraordinary engineering skills that the National Trust in Britain has just released a pair of Eurasian beavers on Exmoor in an effort to curb flooding and improve biodiversity.
It's a boy and girl beaver, so what they might do is find each other very quickly, probably tonight. If they don't breed this year, they will breed next year. And as soon as they breed, they'll start to create dams and impoundments and the pens that we put in there. They'll fell trees, they'll open the land to sunlight. It will fill with insects and plants and pollens. They'll change the landscape completely.
The Eurasian beaver, or European beaver, is a species that was once widespread in Eurasia, but it was hunted to near extinction for both its fur and for the medicine and musk made from their glands. By the early 1900s, only about 1,200 beavers survived in 8 populations in Europe and Asia. But since then, reintroduction programmes have seen a revival in numbers. The story of Devon's beavers is one of the great rewilding tales. The Devon Wild Colony is the UK's first in more than 400 years and has been a huge success. This clip from Hugh's Wild West on the BBC shows how beavers are becoming increasingly visible in this part of England.
There's a tree down here, Mark. That's not beavers.
Yeah,
is it?
This is beavers. So
is it? Ah, oh, that is massive. That's a Devon beaver.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've never really seen anything like it.
You can see all the teeth marks all the way across here.
Ah, oh, that's extraordinary. And he wants this tree to come down?
Yeah, primarily so that he can reach the top branches. So he's feeding on the top branches or using the sticks for lodge building, that sort of thing. But also, because it's a willow tree, this will re-sprout. So there'll be lots of fresh young growth come from this tree next year that will then be food for beavers in future years.
Mark Elliott of the Devon Wildlife Trust bringing that clip to an end. And Mark joins us now from the studios in Plymouth. Mark, tell us the story of your beavers.
We've been working down on the River Otter in East Devon, and we had a family group of beavers living on the river probably as far back as 2008, we think. But there was a proposal by the government to round them up and bring them back into captivity. And the local residents got really upset about that. So we got involved and basically proposed a trial, a 5-year trial, to understand the impacts that the beavers are having on the river and to see whether people and beavers can coexist in this fairly productive agricultural landscape.
Why did the government want to round them up in the first place?
Well, at that point, there was a concern about a parasite called Echinococcus, which we don't have in this country. It's a parasite that's found in foxes, particularly across continental Europe. But rodents are part of the life cycle. And there was a concern that because nobody knew where the beavers had come from, they could have brought this parasite in with them. So that was their primary reason back in 2015 for wanting to round the beavers up.
But they weren't sure the parasite was there.
No, not at all. It's a precautionary thing. We don't have this disease in the country, and it's a disease that's really quite serious. It affects people, and it's the reason why we have a pet passport scheme to prevent dogs bringing the disease into Britain. So it's certainly not something that should have been taken lightly.
And what happened to those beavers that were captured and brought into captivity?
So they were only briefly held. They were rounded up by the vets from DEFRA. They were tested for this disease, and then they were given back to us, and we then re-released them back into their territories.
So when was that?
That happened in 2015. So that was at the very beginning of the trial. And the licence runs for 5 years from that date. So we're just coming to the end of that 5-year trial period now.
Now you say trial period. So what are you looking at during that time frame?
Well, we're trying to understand a whole range of different things, really. Firstly, the impacts on the environment that they're living in. So we're looking at the biodiversity of the river, looking at fish particularly, looking at the ecological value of various sites where they've been living. We're also interested in the impact they're having on agriculture, because there's certainly some low-lying parts of the catchment where we've got mostly pastoral lands, agriculture, but, you know, nevertheless, there's definitely a potential impact there. We're looking at the socioeconomics, so whether the local businesses are benefiting from having beavers around, whether the presence of beaver dams in the headwaters can reduce flooding downstream, and that's one of the things that we've looked at in quite a lot of detail. And we're also trying to understand how the beavers are fitting back into this empty niche, if you like. You know, they're a native species to Britain, so what happens when you put this animal back into the landscape where it was before?
But these beavers appeared there, so they weren't introduced formally. Somebody snuck them in, is that right?
They either were illegally released, or probably more likely is that they escaped from an enclosure, which there was an enclosure in the valley, so it's certainly possible that that they escaped from there.
And then they're having this big, huge impact on the whole area, because beavers, of course, are a keystone species, if you like, so they actually change the whole habitat in which they are, which then affects the other creatures that live there too. So you don't embark upon them lightly, I suppose.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think we've all been really impressed with just how dramatic their impacts can be, you know, in a very positive way in terms of the dynamism of the watercourse. You know, we're seeing some really dramatic changes to the way the watercourse functions, but clearly that comes with it a whole host of potential conflicts with existing land use. And so it's really been about trying to understand those in a bit more detail and to trial different techniques for managing some of those conflicts.
Well, I was watching Channel 4 News the other evening, and they had a report on beavers being reintroduced by the National Trust in Sussex.
That's right. Yeah, they've reintroduced two family groups of beavers into two separate enclosures. And we've got quite a few different sites around the country where beavers are living within fences. And this is two more that are going in this week. And they're all looking at slightly different things. There's different research elements going on in all of these proposed enclosures.
Is it true that the American beaver is the one that creates these enormous dams, and that the European beaver isn't quite so destructive in that way? It doesn't create enormous things. So people get the impression that, oh, if we bring back beavers, we'll have things 100 metres long blocking our rivers. But that isn't the case. They go to little backwaters and things, little irrigation ditches and places like that where it isn't harmful. Is that true?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that's right. What we are seeing in Devon anyway is there are some pretty impressive dams, and the size of the dams is often related to just how long the beavers have been living on a particular site. So I suspect that what's happened in North America with a lot of these areas is that the beavers have just been there for decades, and have, you know, these dams have become really big and really established. I think where we have seen a beaver family group living in a particular area for a long time and have been allowed to get on with it, then they've produced some pretty impressive dams and created some amazing wetland habitats. Well, exactly, we call them a keystone species for exactly that reason, because they just create these phenomenal new wetlands.
Why do they make dams? Is it to create food for them, or what's the raison d'etre? I mean, they're so unusual compared to other animals.
The main reason that they're building dams, and this is the reason why they only do it in the headwaters rather than in the main rivers, is because they're looking for the safety of deep water. So they like to have an underwater burrow entrance so that they can disappear if they're threatened by predators. So they can dive underwater and they can disappear into their burrow. So that's one really fundamental reason. They really do operate very well in water. They're a semi-aquatic mammal, really. By creating dams, they can extend the amount of habitat that they've got available to them, and it allows them to explore off the main watercourse. So if you've created a dam in a headwater stream, it's pushing water sideways, and they'll often build canals off in those sideways directions as well. And that does then allow them to access the willow, particularly, that they feed on during the winter months. But the rest of the time, they're feeding very much on soft vegetation, any riverside plants. They're entirely vegetarian, so there's no fish as part of the diet, but they're feeding on a whole range of different plant species.
It has been claimed that they benefit the fish population. There was some work in Sweden which showed quite a significant increase in the number of minnow and, I think, trout, where beavers were operating, vis-a-vis similar habitat where beavers were not allowed to operate. They modify the habitat in the fish's favour. Or would you argue that?
No, I totally agree with that. And that's what we've seen here on the River Otter. It very much depends on where in the catchment they are building dams, but certainly in the higher energy streams, they are creating this or returning this dynamism, which is creating riffles and pools and a much more diverse habitat for fish. So we've seen new riffles created, which are then used by trout for spawning. So we're seeing the fry actually in these new riffles that have been completely created by the beavers. We've got beaver pools just upstream of the dams that they've built, and we've seen a 37% increase in the number of fish in those pools, including some really large trout. So we're certainly seeing a positive impact on the natural fish populations.
Mark, we've never had beavers in Ireland, so we've no intention of introducing them here. But I think there are lessons to be learned from introductions generally and translocations. And I presume you have been following the IUCN guidelines now as best you can. And one of the first principles there is where do you get your source population from? Is there any knowledge of the genetic makeup of the original pair? And what have you been doing to supplement that since?
We do know that the original pair are Bavarian in origin, so their genetic origin is Bavarian, which is quite a healthy stock of beavers in Europe. But what we have done, because there was the concern of inbreeding, because we really did look like it was starting with one pair, we have brought in an additional 5 beavers into the population just to stir up the genes a bit and bring some new material in. And I think that process will have to go on, because, you know, a lot of our populations that we've got in various enclosures will all be quite isolated, and so mixing up the genes is going to be part of that reintroduction, just so that we are following those IUCN guidelines.
And is that based on a historical knowledge of what might have been present in England back in the day? I know in Scotland, for example, they've gone for Scandinavian beavers.
They certainly started off with Scandinavian beavers, but they have since supplemented the population up there with Bavarian beavers as well. So because of how we started on the River Otter, you know, because the beavers came from an unknown source, then we didn't have the opportunity to choose the genetic stock that we were releasing. But I think the beavers certainly that we have released do seem to be very healthy, and they seem to be thriving. You know, they've spread really well in the river. They seem to be well adapted to the environment that they've found themselves in.
Now, one of the reasons you're here today, Ferdy, is because we wanted to ask you, would there be any consideration to bring beavers into Ireland?
No.
Well, why not?
So, well, as we've mentioned, there are IUCN, so International Union for the Conservation of Nature, have established international best practice in terms of translocations and reintroductions. And the first point is, was this species ever present in the territory before? And if the answer is no, then you move on to another species. So,
but the answer isn't no. The answer is we don't know.
Well, the answer is we have no evidence
absence
that it was.
Absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
So I think what we will be prioritising if we do consider any further introductions are obviously species that were present and have been shown to be present in Ireland.
But based on what Marcus said, do you think there'd be of any benefit to the landscape here?
Who knows?
Who knows?
I mean, giraffes might be as well.
Well, we have giraffes in Cork and Dublin Zoo, perhaps.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's very interesting to look at these projects that are going on, and the Scottish one is a little bit further down the road, but the Devon one obviously is following that same path. And one of the big things is discussions with stakeholders. So I don't know, Mark, how much of that is ongoing? Do you have a lot of, for example, do you have concerned fishermen that you have to meet regularly and assuage their concerns? What sort of problems do you have?
We do have quite a number of different stakeholder groups that we work with, and the fishing community are certainly one of those. And there's been some concern expressed certainly by some of the anglers, particularly the salmon anglers, that beaver dams might prevent the migration of salmon upstream. We've certainly seen down here on the River Otter sea trout getting over beaver dams in certain conditions. You know, when you get a good flow coming down, they are able to get over certain dams. But that doesn't mean there's no issue at all. But when the evidence has been presented to the various stakeholder groups, you know, a lot of people are relaxing and seeing the benefits that they're bringing. Not in all cases, but certainly in most cases.
Ferdy, you mentioned Scotland there, and earlier today, researcher John Bell O'Reilly spoke to Dr. Roisin Campbell-Palmer from a remote log cabin in Aberdeenshire. That's where she was. He was here in the studios in Donnybrook. Anyway, beavers were reintroduced into Scotland in 2009 and have since been granted protected status. Roisin is a beaver expert and field operations manager with the Scottish Beaver Trial.
Roisin, as I understand it, the Scottish Beaver Trial started about 10 years ago. What prompted the trial?
Well, I think there was a lot of interest generally in beavers and their restoration to Britain, especially Scotland. And I think people were keen to see this species back. So it was a building amount of pressure for both the government to do something, but also the conservation bodies to do something. So if you think about at least 10, 15 years before that, there was lots of research, lots of academic debates, lots of media interest. So the trial was really, you know, the end of a long process of discussing bringing back this species to Scotland.
How many animals were released and what are numbers today?
So as part of the official project, we were licensed to release four families of beavers. And those were ones that we went and trapped in Norway with Norwegian scientists and brought over to Scotland and health screened. And they went through quarantine, etc., and were released. Now, numbers today are estimated to at least about 400 or 500, if not more. That's a kind of minimum. But just to stress, these didn't come from these four families. And numbers are also increased by animals that have escaped from captivity, for example. So we don't know exactly how
from
many
from captivity
animals,
from private collections.
From private collections, yes. So slight problem is we don't have a baseline number of how many animals actually were released in Scotland, apart from the ones we know we officially released, if you see what I mean. But now we know there's several hundred in parts of Scotland, and they're just, you know, encouraged, you know, they're breeding very well and they're spreading along river systems.
What location in Scotland was chosen 10 years ago and why?
So Argyll was chosen for the official release, and that was selected because, there was one big landowner really in the area we wanted to put beavers back, and that was the Forestry Commission. So very easy to work with, good access, easy to gain permission for the animals to go out. But also Argyll is a lovely, beautiful, scenic place. There's lots of trees, obviously, lots of river systems and lochs. So really perfect habitat for beavers to spread out from.
Some of the negative impacts, Róisín, are some of the unintended consequences.
So it really depends where the beavers are and what habitat they're existing in. And most of our conflicts really arise when beavers are living in agricultural landscapes. And that's where, you know, crops are close to the water's edge. There's lots of drainage ditches, for example. And the main kind of conflict we're coming across is when beavers dam those sort of areas. Sometimes they burrow into the banks and that can cause erosion. But I would say probably our major issue is dams in unwanted places.
And how has public support for the project been overall?
It's still very high. We've done repeated public and local and national public consultations. And still, the majority of people, even though there's conflicts in some areas, do want to see this species restored.
That was Róisín talking to our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly, earlier today. So seems like the public want them back in Scotland. Can I ask a really kind of stupid question? And I do know the answer to it, but I'll ask it anyway for the benefit of the listeners. Is it possible that these beavers could get here of their own volition, do you think, Ferdia?
Well, they're a freshwater species, so I think it's very unlikely. Unlike the otter, for example, which has coastal and freshwater, the beaver is very much a freshwater.
And there's no chance of anybody bringing them in a private collection and then they escape.
Well, that would be illegal.
Yep. Okay.
We've had similar issues with koipu recently, which we've had to go out and exterminate, obviously.
And you got them out, you got rid of the koipu, you did?
Well, we had to, yeah. We had to remove them because of the risks associated.
Just tell people what the koipu are again, if you would, please.
Well, the koipu is, it's not even as big as a beaver, but it's another rodent species, but it's a South American species, obviously completely exotic and not native to Europe, and causes huge damage to agricultural crops and to drainage systems.
There was lots of scare stories, headlines in the newspapers, I remember. Was it last year, the year before, when there's giant rats were being spotted around the country?
There's a guy on Twitter called the Cork Koipu who's living off it still.
So unless we build a bridge across to France, or we build a bridge across to Scotland, they're not going to swim across the sea.
No. No.
Well, there's talk of a tunnel linking Britain and Northern Ireland, wasn't there, at one stage? At any rate, Mark, so it's been good for you guys. Do you think that that's it? You're going to be allowed to bring the beavers back? Do you have to apply for a licence now? What way does it work? What's going to happen?
Well, at the moment, it's the decision's with the government. So we've been required to produce a series of reports for the government that just outline the findings of the trial. And then once the trial comes to an end, it will then be up to the government to decide what happens, firstly, to the beavers that are living on the otter, whether they're allowed to spread naturally from there, what would happen to the other populations of beavers that we know are out there in other parts of England and Wales, and also things like legal protection and funding, most importantly, for the management of conflicts in the future. Because if you are going to have beavers back in a landscape, it's really vital that the support is there for those people that are being impacted by them, and potentially funding landowners to allow beavers to create wetlands so that the benefits that beavers will bring can be enjoyed by the rest of society, particularly those people that are at risk of flooding downstream. So there needs to be some funding for this as well.
Mark Elliott, thank you very much indeed.
That's quite all right. No problem at all.